Meeting of the Planning and Development Committee for Tuesday, August 4th, a little bit after 2 p.m. The next item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from the July 6, 2020 meeting.
Move for approval, Madam Chairman.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Our next item on our agenda is Employee Years of Service Recognition. Mr. Alma?
Oh, let me come in.
Thank you. Good afternoon. We're on, right?
Doesn't sound like it.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry. I skipped the public comments. Sorry. Our next item on the agenda is public comment. I apologize. Thank you. Thank you. I'm just trying to move us through this. Next item is public comment. If you are here to speak in public, please state your name and address for the record. Come up to the podium, and in between each speaker, we'll be cleaning off the microphone in between each speaker. So just come, state your name and address, and you have 2 minutes. Is there anyone here for public comment?
My name is Antonia Macedo. I live at 1246 Mile Road, lot number 27. I've lived there for 20 years. My husband and I have spent thousands of dollars planting trees, bushes, shrubbery, building decks, a greenhouse, and we're being told that this property is trying to be annexed to Mount Pleasant to be subdivided, and there could be a possibility that we would have to move. We are all mobile home owners there. There are 30 homes, 30 lots. We're in no position to be able to afford to move our home, let alone purchase any land. We've looked into purchasing land. It's the least you can buy is $45,000. That's in Hugie, and it's not developed. It's all full of trees. You'd have to have it developed in order for us to move it. So we have no complaints about Watts. They have been good to us the 20 years we've lived there. We love our neighbors, we love our neighborhood, and we don't want to be squeezed out. It's low income housing. It's a place where we can afford, and we're scared. This is a time of COVID. Where are we going to go? How are we going to move our house? How are we going to survive? If this gets annexed into Mount Pleasant and gets sewer and subdivided, it's probably going to be sold, and our houses will have to be moved, and they'll build expensive housing there. We would like the right to buy our lot, or to be heard that we need some help in this matter. We're scared. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
I don't know if you've changed this rules the way you don't speak on the item or not.
Yeah, you spoke public comments all at the beginning of the meeting.
Well, I can wait until the item comes up then.
No, you speak at the beginning of the meeting.
Okay, public that's comments. What I said. You did change it then. Yeah. Okay. George Freeman, 1450 Bowen Road, Director of Community Activity for CAGE. I'm here to speak against the R4 zoning for the trailer park the young lady was just speaking about. This is in the 6 Mile community in the Sweetgrass Basket overlay. We appreciate it when you disapprove the one zoning on Annie Laurel Lane last time. And the reason we've been protesting ever since those zonings have been occurring on Annie Laurel Lane is because we have felt it would lead to something like this. This is one of our greatest nightmares. We hope that you do not approve this, because we would like to keep our community with the open space and with all the trees that we have in our community right now. The area that they're talking about right now, there are a lot of trees in that area, which helps to beautify the community, and we would like to keep it that way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Charlie Carmody with CBRE. I represent the Miller family. I live at 107 New Street in the Old Village of Mount Pleasant. We were told at the last full town council meeting where we talked about the heights that a committee of town council would meet with the property owners. And I know that we've had COVID going on and all of that. But before, I'd like to request that before y'all make a recommendation to town council, that you do in fact meet with some of the property owners to talk about why it is they ought to have a higher density or a higher height in some locations as opposed to others. We were told that that would happen, and we'd like to see that happen. I just want to make that statement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else for public comment? Oh, come on.
My name is Paula Baldwin. I live at 1246 Mile Road, Lot 25. And I'm going to read my statement.
I'm sorry. Can you just remove your mask while you're speaking?
Oh, I'd love to.
I get a little better.
Thanks. Okay. Everyone has a story to tell as to why it would be impossible for us to move out of the Norwood Oaks neighborhood of 6 Mile Road. I do not know everyone's story, but I do know my own. It is not more or less important than anyone else's, but I felt it was necessary to tell. I once was married to a soldier for 19 years. I left him in 1992 for crimes he committed against our family. It was at that point I became a single mother of 3 daughters. I had a difficult childhood, grew up poor, but proud, and not being a stranger to hard work, I was prepared for the road ahead. I've often worked 2 jobs to keep us afloat while continually pursuing my passion to write and sell my books. I'm an author of 2 children's books, a novel, and poetry that have been published. My plan has always been to retire one day to devote more time to write. 2 years ago, I finally was able to retire to pursue this full time. My mobile home is the first home I have owned. Moving there was my 25th move since 1992. So not wanting to move again and now physically unable, I questioned Philip Watts as to the probability of me ever having to move if I made the decision to buy my home. He assured me that this would never happen because it was in the will that the brothers could not sell while they were alive. I also asked if they could cut back the trees over my mobile home, and he assured me it would be done. I have not complained about the things that was never done because I was so happy to finally feel safe and secure. I planted a flower garden, a vegetable garden, a cactus garden, and a shale garden. I've created an arbor over my pond, extended my patio multiple times, added wood mulch to the driveway to try and stop the flooding in my yard. Last year, after Hurricane Dorian, we had to cut up a fallen tree, repair a fence, and add a new roof. Because I've planted trees across the United States and Europe, but have never had the opportunity to watch any of them grow, I also planted a tree here and have enjoyed watching its upward reach for the sky. I have not done anything alone because since I was a young child, I knew I needed an advocate, a champion who would defend the weak, the vulnerable, the poor, the lame, the fatherless, the widows, and the brokenhearted. We have all of these here in Norwood Oaks. However, our advocate is the Lord God Almighty. We represent the lower income working class that are being driven out of their homes because of corporate greed. Soon you will have no one to fill the jobs that the upper class can afford to sit back and watch us do. Who will bag your groceries, fill your prescriptions, nurse your children, open your drawbridges, and write our stories if we have no place to live? My prayer and heartfelt desire are that we could own the land we live on, that we've improved upon with our blood, sweat, tears, and limited budgets. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me speak today. I too live at 1246 Mile Road. I'm 81 years old, sold my home at Lake Marion last July and August, and had to pay several months to hold my lot at Watts' Mobile Home Park, where I've lived 2 different times in my life there. paid in advance to go. No one told me when I put the proceeds of selling my home on the lake into my new trailer home that I may be evicted or have to move it or it was up for sale. I kind of feel that it's my home, my son and his wife live there, and my grandson and his wife and great-granddaughter live there too, since about 1981. So it's my third time of living in the park. I feel that at the time that I came aboard, that I should have been warned that there was a possibility that they would sell it, and I haven't only been there 6 months. So I kind of resent the imposition that I put in as putting out to sell my home and my new home and moving in there. And at my age, to pick up and move again, it's a really hard job. And where would I go that I could afford now? Because I'm sure if I have to sell my new 2020 mobile home, it would be at a loss. And then where could I go? And how could I afford to move it since I put all my money in there? I put down sod, landscaping. I put my little stimulus check in the yard, and it does flood, but I'm home. And I feel like everybody else in our park, we just kind of, at the last minute, are victims of an overproduced building in Mount Pleasant. Anyhow, how many of us could afford $400,000 or $500,000 homes? And I would have trouble getting a 30-year mortgage. He bought 110 when I pay for it. Hope I hold up that long. But anyhow, that's why I'm here today, just to say, if there's a possibility, we need a break. And appreciate your help, and thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Could you give us your name, please, ma'am?
It's Gwendolyn Smith, 1246 Mile Road, Lot 5, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina.
Thank you.
Moved in there in 1982, moved out, moved back.
Yeah.
And now I'm old, you know, and I don't want to move again. Thank you.
All right, do we have anyone else for public comment? All right, moving on to item 4 on the agenda, for real this time, Mr. Alma, Employee Service of Recognition.
Thank you, Ms. Whitley. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Michelle, you want to get as close as you can to me? Maybe that chair, right? No. Yeah, maybe that chair, because that's a familiar spot for them seeing you all the time, right? Michelle Reed joined the Planning and Development Department in 2015, and she brought several years of planning experience at different regional planning agencies to the town of Mount Pleasant and our organization. She works, and you see her in action, in our zoning administration area and oversees activities related to annexations, rezonings, impact assessments, plan developments, zoning code text amendments, and historic district certificates of appropriateness. She's also been involved with special studies like affordable and workforce housing, and most recently on the Shem Creek Special Management Area Plan. Over the past 5 years, Michelle has shepherded and juggled dozens of initial zoning and rezoning cases, starting with the scoping and due diligence meetings with property owners, developers, and attorneys, and then ending with final readings by council, a process which you know takes sometimes years to complete. She's also familiar because she's handled numerous zoning ordinance text amendments, including accessory dwelling units, extensive updates to tree and buffer regulations, amendments to the urban corridor overlay district, even changing the name. And of course, everybody's favorite, short-term rentals. These have not been simple or mundane topics or issues. Those efforts have had considerable discussion, public involvement, and changes in direction as they have moved from issue identification to completion. So while you see her at committee and council and commission meetings, she spends considerable time working behind the scenes to make things as smooth and manageable as possible. She serves in a key role as the staff liaison to the Planning Commission, managing all their agendas, communications, correspondence, and logistics. She's also led the efforts to provide state-mandated training for all of our board and commission members. She must also coordinate with other staff for the preparation of staff reports, review of agenda items, and to gain input on ordinance changes. And as you might expect, while one case or text amendments could be small or narrow in scope, there are always inquiries from all around the area and nearby residents and the news media. and Michelle consistently uses her calm, friendly, common sense, professional approach as she informs and advises whoever is on the end of the line or the other end of the email. Michelle fills a key role in the planning department as she coordinates this high-profile work to get it all accomplished. It doesn't hurt that she knows teamwork. From her days as a record-holding high school basketball player in Indiana, and we're really glad that she's on our team. So let's thank her for 5 years of outstanding work serving the citizens of Mount Pleasant.
Ask up or down?
It's on your chin.
Here, I'm handing you a pen somewhere on my desk. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Number five on the agenda is review, discussion, and possible action regarding ordinances pertaining to building heights.
Speaking of ordinance amendments, text amendments.
You are familiar with this, having most recently discussed it together, the entire council last week. And so what I'll do is go immediately to what we picked up on at last week's discussion on potential changes to the building heights map that would apply along the Johnny Dodds Boulevard and some other related areas adjacent to that. And pointer will work. This option was developed off option D. Mr. Chapman had worked on and had shared with the council. And so moving from the bridge end, it retains and reduces the 80 to a 70-foot area here. This is Houston Northcutt running at this location. So 70 feet would stay closest to the bridge, transitioning down to a 60-foot area, which would include Town Hall, for instance. It would retain the 55-foot height limit moving all the way up Johnny Dodds to Bowman Road, and then it would reduce what were all 80-foot heights in this vicinity at the upper end to 60 feet straddling Johnny Dodds, 80 feet retained at the hospital area, lowering to 50 and even down to 40 feet at the southern tip of this general vicinity. It also includes the discussion or the special notes that relate to the map itself. In the white box, we note that under the existing regulations, any development within this shaded area, within the colored area, that's located either within 50 feet of property immediately adjacent on the exterior, or a property that's residential across even a street or a road that's residential, the height limit in all of these zones is 40 feet. And it's measured, would be measured from the grade to the eaves, and it could not be more than 3 stories in height. In addition, we've added in the note language that council discussed for step back building design above 3 stories. So for any building within 50 feet of a public street, so development facing the public realm, which would go beyond 3 stories, the facade of any additional floor that faces the street would have to be stepped back at least 20 feet behind the facade of the story or the floor below. And for comparison, this is the after, and you have the before in the upper left, so where we started, and then the evolution of changes to produce option F. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to you for discussion or comment, and whether or not we got this version right.
Thank you. I think this does encapsulate what we said in full council at the meeting. Does anyone have any comments on this before we send it back to full council for Tuesday?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the planning department for their efforts to try to get 9 people from our last meeting on the same page. And I think option F essentially does it. And I was concerned about changing from what I'd suggested, from 50 to 55, but I think the step backs makes a lot of sense, and it protects the residential areas that could be impacted. So I'm very happy that we, I think, have come to a common goal of trying to protect the residences, but also look out for commercial activities that are either in place or we think might be coming. So it's a difficult job, and they did a great job helping us do it.
Thank you.
Ms. Corley?
I just have a quick question. I thought we went in.
Ms. Corley, if I can just have you move your mic. Yep, thank you.
I thought when we discussed it last time that step back was going to be 50. Am I wrong? Did we not talk about
part of the discussion at the time was in the comprehensive plan for the redevelopment areas that as a draft had 50 feet of step back, but we illustrated what would be roughly a 20-foot in that building that we used as an example. So we sort of changed our thinking on whether it needs to be 50-foot step back versus the 20. So that's what was, we had some options, but we understood it that showing that illustration and using a 20-foot setback should be sufficient to move those upper floors back at an angle that would sort of minimize that impact on the street.
Ms. Hyatt?
You still asking?
No.
Yeah, I
was comfortable with the way it was written. I guess on the comp plan, it mentions the 50 feet, because 20 feet would be just like a portico or a porch. I mean, to me, that doesn't seem quite far enough. But when I read it in the comp plan, it said 50 feet. That made more sense. Anybody else?
Well, I think
as a point of reference, I mean, 20 feet, if you were at the corner of the third story and you moved it back 20 feet, a floor of approximately 10 feet would go up half the height of that 20 foot. So you've got an angle that where the sort of the horizontal dimension is two times the vertical change. So it sort of steps back at that less than a 45 degree angle. That'd be 1:1. So it takes it back to an angle, a shallower angle that pushes that back to behind. And that's, again, what we illustrated on that one building that we used as an example. But
I think that the concern that I had and that many people had was this sort of feeling that you are shadowed in with these sort of close crowded buildings. So I think that if 20 feet gives us that angle where it's not going to be creating these deep shadow, you know, like this feeling that you're going through a tunnel, like a concrete tunnel, do you believe that 20 feet is sufficient? I guess the question is 50 feet prohibitive to the concept of building, you know, the size of the building?
This is the one that we did use. And this is very similar, I think, on the Coleman, on the Broadway project that we did. I believe it was set back at a same slope. Yeah, it's the same slope that we did on that building for the self-storage. Was for every foot you went up, you had to slide back 2 feet. So it's that same angle pushing that down. And this is where I showed you all that this was about the sort of that 20, 25 foot mark on this building. So you'd actually be pushing it probably, if the floor plates and the space that they need underneath is sort of architecturally important and the way they design space for utilization, then it would kind of take it back a little further. And this would actually be more than that slope. It'd be further back than probably the height of the floor is roughly 13 and a half feet. But that's the council's prerogative in terms of how far you think. If you went 50 feet on this particular drawing, you'd be back probably halfway or so into this sort of unit of the building, if you can see that. You'd make Jeff's rooftop restaurant and bar plaza bigger, but I'm not sure in terms of the effect it would have on the constructability or the space utilization, say, of an office building like this. We can look at that further if you want to, but.
I mean, personally, I'm comfortable with the 20 feet. I feel like if that takes care of the shadowing issues, that's okay. I feel like 50 feet, it would be prohibitive of the building size to do the actual construction and make it a feasible project. And I think that we have to have a good balance here between, you know, preserving the feel of our community, which I think something like this little rooftop greenery area does, and encouraging businesses to come and develop in our property. So I'm comfortable with it as is, but if there are others that are not, I understand that.
One other consideration would be, say, any building on a corner. So you'd be fronting on two streets. This would be applicable in both directions. So by the time you applied it from one and the other, we're not sure what kind of upper floor you would get in terms of space. It might look more like a cupola than an integral part of the building.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I'm concerned about constructability, and I think if you go 50 feet looking at what the impact would be on this building, I'm concerned about the constructability of it. So I'm comfortable with what I thought we came up with at the council meeting.
Okay, great. Ms. Corley, do you have anything?
There's no way to go 30. I mean, is it?
You could have a different one. We'd have to look at different buildings or step backs or kind of, again, check out floor space in buildings and or talk to architects and designers to see what implications that would have.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, because this would change. This is on the height map, but the comp plan says 50 feet. So would change to match this?
Yeah, and that's what we talked about a lot last week, is whichever way you go on any of these, they need to jive. Mm-hmm. And so again, the 50 came out of the sort of the bigger, broader, and trying to introduce that step back. This is perhaps more refined than that broad in general, as we've looked at these centers and these redevelopment areas. Lots of communities even go less than that. So their step back is 10 feet, some as little as 5.
Wow.
Just to get a different treatment along that upper level. So we went and suggested the 20.
Right. Do I have a motion that we can send to council?
I'll make a motion that we recommend to town council option F as presented.
Do I have a second?
Anyone? I'll second that.
Okay, and we're back into discussion. Is there any further discussion of this? Ms. Hyatt, did you have something?
I'm trying to remember how we factored in the size of the property too when it came to step backs. I'm trying to find
that. Was
I think
removed.
We decided to remove that, so there's no minimum.
So there is no limitation. It's applicable to.
Right. I knew there was no limit, but then how would it work, like on a big piece?
Well, they would still be maxed out by the cap of the height limit that we have there.
I mean, they're going to step back every how often? It's more than once, right?
Every 20 feet.
Okay.
Each floor would go back again.
Okay.
The way this is
each
written.
Each floor. All right. That's what I was trying to.
It maintains that angle, that
right.
slope of right. keeping the building under that
it's
angle
give
slope.
It a very,
for the wedding
it's
cake.
Going to give it a very sharp step look to
well,
it.
I think that what the goal with that though is that if you're standing on the street, you're not seeing how big the building is. You're not feeling that sort of enclosed in a concrete tunnel
yeah.
sort of New York, downtown New York style feel of things. All right. Are there any further discussion before we vote on this? Yep. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Recommendation to council for approval. Item number 6 on the agenda is annexations. A is Murdoch Drive.
Oh.
Yes. This is one that you've seen a couple of times. Asked us to get a little bit more information about the potential development adjacent to this property. So this is off Highway 41. And we've shown you with access off Canyon Lane. Here's the site aerial photo again. It would be designated as community conservation zoning, and it's about a four-acre tract, and our understanding is the owner is interested in building a single residence on the site. This is the location, and we were updating for you, and we had it last time looking like, well, I don't have it in there. We received the new updated preliminary plat from the county. Remember, this could be developed under the county in terms of subdividing it. Ultimately, building permits would then be secured from the town. This is the layout, and originally we were thinking that this, here's the street access coming in, and then you have this other street that loops around. It provides connections, interconnections to this property to the west, but it's not lined up with this property that's subject to annexation, this blue. The back roughly quarter of the property, through their analysis, there's wetlands and open space areas. So the lots end right at about the point. So unless this were redesigned and the street were forced to try to connect over here to this, in this direction to the blue property, at this point, there is not proposed to be provided a direct interconnection from the property being requested for annexation to this potential new subdivision. So that's new information that we had, that we were asked to obtain, and that's where we are at this point.
Do you have any motion? Or do we have discussion? Oh. Mr. Chapman?
I've got some more questions for Mr. Ulma before I'm ready to make a motion, because I guess I'm the guilty party who has dragged this out. Did we have any discussions with the property owner that actually has access other than Canyon to Highway 41?
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
Well, I thought it was requested that we make contact with the developer for the subdivision shown here.
Yes, and this is the new and updated information superimposed now adjacent to the piece that's subject to annexation.
And what did the developer say about potential
that this was the, this was their layout as they had proposed it and been working with the county. So they would have to redraw this project at this upper end in order
to... And in doing that, would they be willing to do that?
I don't believe so. They sort of seemed like they were fixed on where they wanted to head. Ultimately, if it connected, conceivably, there could be a connection that would go to the immediately adjacent property, and at some point, this property and this one could be interconnected to go to here and then come down the street. But that's a long-term play.
Right, but it's not there today.
Versus immediately.
So immediately, this property is accessible through a private drive?
Yes, on this other side over here, running through to Canyon. So effectively, it's a driveway that goes back to this, to the four-acre parcel.
Do we have any idea of when the subdivision shown here is scheduled to begin work?
This is new, and I think they just finished this in April or May, this layout. And so it was, I think we mentioned almost 10 years ago that this was discussed. So they are moving at this point with this layout with the county. So more imminent than it was several years ago.
I'm not prepared to make a motion, I'll tell you right now.
For a recommendation either way?
Either way.
What information, more information do you feel that we need?
What's going to happen is we're going to have a driveway or a road right near Canyon. We're working on a better solution for Highway 41. That's not a real good solution as of what's there now. If that subdivision could tie into Canyon, then yeah, I think it would be fine. But
the new subdivision?
Well, the subdivision that you showed.
It does tie. So that southern end is Canyon, but it's not directly tied or designed to connect to the blue parcel in the back that's subject. So this is Canyon on this southern end. So it does bring, that subdivision lays right in this sort of skewed rectangle, but the upper end stays as open space.
Okay.
And then so, it comes to Canyon here and then goes to 41.
So it is tying, that new subdivision is tying in
to Canyon.
To Canyon.
Yes, sir.
And Canyon will be the intersection
with 41.
With 41.
Yes, sir.
Well, I like that better because eventually Canyon will tie in, or this does now. The way you access this road, which is Murdoch Drive,
is from
ties into Canyon, and then Canyon will tie into the new subdivision, as well as Canyon will tie into 41. So I feel better about that now that I understand it. I'll make a motion to approve the annexation.
Do we have a second?
Can you repeat the motion? I'm sorry.
The motion is to approve the annexation.
Murdoch.
Another question.
Oh. Until we have a second. Do we have a second? Do you want a second for the purposes of discussion, anyone?
Okay. I'll second.
Okay. Ms. Corley.
Just another question, Jeff. And I think I've asked you this before, and I forgot your answer. But when it comes to annexations like this, do we just keep growing and saying yes? Like, right, what's in it for us, I guess, right? So what's in it for the town with an annexation?
Yes, and that's sort of the overall policy question for the council, whether or not to annex a piece of property. And you see in the crosshatched areas here, this entire lower area is a big donut hole, if you will, with corporate limits, you know, surrounding it, at least on one side here. Which is what makes this one contiguous. It's coming, the contiguity is coming from what's in behind it, not sort of in a more logical way of building in the front and then moving to the back. It's kind of in reverse.
Okay.
But you have others that have started, and it becomes the question of, is this, you know, how does council feel about annexing additional property and ultimately providing services to those areas? As opposed to, it could develop in the county anyway.
Right.
And so it becomes a matter of
who dictates what goes there.
Yes, Mr. DeMora. Mr. DeMora.
Didn't mean to interrupt, Ms. Corley. Continuity and control. Fairness to taxpayers, those are important. But in that area, if those other properties are unlikely to destine into the town of Mount Pleasant, then why bother at that point? If look at all the other property. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Fairness to our taxpayers, continuity, control, all those things are extremely important and have guided our annexation policy for many, many years. Hard part about this area, if you'll go back, Jeff, to that right there, is it is unlikely. I mean, how many years or decades will it take for those properties to end up being into the town of Mount Pleasant? Maybe never. There are strategic reasons also to annex. But this one will likely go. Others will likely not. So we'll be running for likely decades. We'll be running our public services out there for little return to our taxpayers.
Okay.
In this area.
Okay.
If it was a large block, if it was preventing annexations from other municipalities, different story. But it's not much gain in this annexation.
Thank you.
It's my opinion.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, are we ready to vote? All those in favor, the motion is to approve annexation. So all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
deny annexation? No.
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 Okay, so three no. So this will go to council with a recommendation to deny annexation. Item number B is the request to annex on Six Mile Road, an 11.54 acre tract. I understand that the applicant has withdrawn or is asking for a deferral.
Yes. So the rezoning and the annexation for this particular property, they've asked for a deferral and an opportunity to work with residents and nearby property owners.
All right. Do we need a motion on that?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Don't we need a motion on that to defer?
What does that mean, though?
Yeah, we need to explain.
They just want to wait, and they would continue working on it, and then it would return when they're ready to return at a future date.
Okay.
And
great, thank you. So this is a deferral.
I'll move that we defer this item on our agenda, both annexation as well as zoning.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. All right. Item B is deferred.
I was just testing David on that.
Item C is Coaxum Road, request to annex a 0.34 acre tract.
Yes.
For approval.
This is in the Snowden community, adjacent to a couple of other properties that have been annexed.
Right, we
Long
have a motion.
Point Road on the south.
I move for approval, Madam Chairman.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carried. Item D, Garden Hill Road. Annex a 1 acre tract of land.
We just received, just before we came here for the meeting, a request from the property owner or representative of the property asking for this annexation and rezoning request to be withdrawn.
Okay.
So they would have to wait a year before resubmitting the same request.
Okay.
This didn't look good.
So if it's withdrawn, there isn't anything in front of you to vote on.
All right, so this item D is withdrawn. Number seven, moving on to item seven on the agenda, review of Planning Commission recommendations. A is a rezoning case.
Michelle's going to go from here.
There's actually a request for deferral on this petition as well. We currently have a text amendment that I think received first reading last month by town council, so it should be receiving final reading next week. But that that text amendment, if you'll recall, has to do with changing some of the requirements in the Old Village, and one particular section of that amendment recommends having being able to recognize and designate historic structures that aren't necessarily within a designated district. And this particular property is right on the edge of the Old Village Historic District. And the recommendation, the request is to go into the Boulevard Overlay District. And so they're hoping that if they defer and wait for the other amendment to go through, that perhaps they can be removed from the Old Village Historic District and still be protected through our new ordinance. And so they would again request a deferral at least for about 3 months, I think.
All right. Do we have such a motion?
Move for deferral of item 7A.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. Item B is the rezoning Key Colony Court. This is the Sullivan's Point. This is, I believe, the final two properties on there that we've seen over and over again.
I move for approval of item 7B.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? No. Item carries. Rezoning case, this is item C, is we've already
this is withdrawn.
This was withdrawn.
Yes, ma'am.
And item D, this was deferred.
Yes, ma'am. 6 Mile for the Northwood Mobile Home Park. They would like to defer. And the Watts family specifically asked to defer so that they could work with some of the folks that live in the community and do a little more outreach.
Great. So. Item E is a zoning ordinance text amendment regarding signs and temporary signs.
Okay, this, some of you will recall, this came up probably about a year ago, but staff initiated this, wanting to revisit this issue, particularly as it has come up. We've been getting calls to remove signs in the right-of-way. We've also continued to kind of struggle with our current definition of a sign, and so this was predominantly driven by needing to make it crystal clear that we can remove signs in the right-of-way. Because having the authority to do that, our code enforcement officer wasn't real clear. And so that was really what drove this text amendment. But we also wanted to clarify a couple things. One is that our current definition of a sign says that it has to be commercial in nature. So if you have a political sign or any other type of sign that is not commercial in nature, technically it's not a sign per our ordinance definition, and so it didn't qualify under the same regulations as a sign. So we wanted to add that language in, saying that a sign can also be a political sign. And then last was, along with the location of where our code enforcement could pick up signs, we also wanted to clarify what sign area was. We've had some pretty creative people in the past get around the requirements of a sign area by splitting it in half and putting two next to each other. And so we wanted to make it clear that you couldn't do that. And so we kind of reestablished what sign area meant. And so that's all I have. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
All right. Do we have a motion?
I move for approval.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Mr. Chapman?
Does this mean that now we can start picking up all of the rogue signs that have been put out since COVID-19?
Well, I know that there's some folks in our office that have been busy picking up signs.
Good.
Doing their best. Of course, you know, we have one guy that does it. But
I tried.
But yes, we'll do our best.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. Item number E7E, item number 8 on the agenda is zoning code and land development regulations assessment, and we're going to have a presentation from our consultants.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let me get the presentation set up. Is it open already? There we go.
I'm just going to do a brief intro that, and then I'm going to turn over the floor to Tyson Smith and Kelly Casino, who've been working on this for us. This is a much needed review of just this is the first step of a process that is a much needed review of our codes to see what's working well and what isn't. Obviously, we're not making any changes yet at this point. We're just kind of trying to figure out which direction we need to go. And so that is the whole, the purpose of this presentation today is to kind of give you some insight into where we're going to need to head in the future as we look to make our codes do exactly what we want them to do and a little more cleanly and clearly. So, guys, if you want to, do you want me to run this or do you want to?
It doesn't matter to me.
Okay.
Am I going to present from up there, I
assume? Yes, please.
Okay.
You can come up here, or you can sit here.
Can I change it from here?
Yeah. I can change it. I don't think you can change it from there.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you? No. Okay. No. I can change it for you, if you'd like.
Okay.
Number one is right there.
Here?
Oh.
All right, we have it under control now. Shall I jump in?
Go for it.
Okay.
All yours.
Good afternoon. My name is Tyson Smith. I'm with a firm called White & Smith Planning and Law Group. We're a full gamut planning and zoning and legal firm, and we help cities and counties around the country on precisely this type of issue, rewriting zoning codes and other land use issues. It just happens to be that we're located in downtown Charleston, so we were very interested in this project, of course, when it came out. As Liz said, we're not embarking on a rewrite today. We haven't for the most recent period of time. What we've been embarking on is what we call an assessment or an evaluation of what needs to be looked at. The background on this is fairly straightforward. Your last update was in 1981, almost 40 years ago. and there hasn't been a comprehensive rewrite since. I would say that most of our clients and communities that are growing at the rate Mount Pleasant is do it probably every 10 to 15 years. Policies change, things get cluttered just by doing these minute changes over a period of time. Staff are just referring to the sign area code being needing to be clarified, and it's full of things like that. You just go through every decade or so and do these types of cleanups. One of the things we've noticed is that the codes are outdated and they're not promoting the design and the development patterns that we believe are what you're looking for according to what's in the comprehensive plan. One of the things you'll see too is that over time there are more modern ways of drafting codes, and we want to implement that sort of thing here. So as you know, words are not as popular as they used to be, so we use and rely on more graphics. We want our procedures to be in flowcharts. We want illustrations that show you what a side yard on a corner lot means, so they're not debates over that. So your applicants don't have to call four times to get an interpretation from staff for something that's fairly straightforward. So that's a big part of what we heard when we did our focus group meeting. So we did those in February. Over a period of 2 days, we heard from builders and other applicants, architects, planners, engineers who are frequently interacting with the planning department. We also heard from town administrators and the planning department, town attorneys as well, and boards. Some of you may have participated in those one of those days with us. We met with commission members and also board members. All that was incorporated into the evaluation in addition to recommendations we have just based on the work we do day to day or in other places in the country. What will we be looking at? Well, technically anything in Title 15, the land usage section of the code, of the municipal code. Most of that's going to focus on land development regulations, what most people in the world call subdivision regulations, but we don't in South Carolina for some reason, and the zoning code in Chapter 156. But anything that interacts with those areas in terms of land use process or land development would be on the table in terms of the update. I wanted to touch on a few points here when we think about why to even undertake this process. When we look at the entire municipal code, it's probably the only section of the code or the only chapters in the code that are engaged with, relied upon every moment of every single day. And as I said here, many evenings, as you know. People see the tip of the iceberg. You see the part you see. Staff sees the part they see. A homeowner sees the part it sees. They see, but it's always functioning, and the physical layout of Mount Pleasant depends on it. What's written in the code, what's not written in the code, it's that important. Even any homeowner or business at some point seems to will need to deal with a construction issue or a redevelopment issue. As I say in the final bullet there, I think it's important that when you do interact with the code, that a reasonable person who puts in a reasonable amount of time can understand what the rules are. And I think we've moved away from that just simply because it's been so long since you've done an update. The goal, as I say on the third point there, is efficiency. And right now you've lost some efficiency in the process just because of all the time that's passed since the last update, which, as I said, is a cost add for the private sector as well as the town itself. Kelly Cousineau from our firm is with us this morning. She's the primary drafter of this code. Many of you recognize Kelly. She was here for about 12 years, and I feel like I owe you an apology. She came to work for us 4 years ago, and she's quite excellent. I appreciate her coming down from Allendale during the pandemic to present. So she's going to walk you through the report. And one thing I would say is this, that we've chosen to err on the side of brevity today because it's the time it is in the afternoon and there's a lot of material here. But if there's anything that we skip over or don't touch deeply enough on, just say we'll stay as long as you want to today. But there's a lot of material to cover. I'm going to ask Kelly to go through it.
Thanks, Tyson. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to take you through kind of a high-level overview of the Development Code's technical evaluation. It's organized into five sections. The bulk of the report is Section 3, which is central themes and primary areas of recommended changes.
I'm sorry, it's not picking up very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should I talk louder?
You can take your mask off.
Either that
or
if you're
comfortable,
Kelly,
taking your mask off, that probably is the best option.
Okay. I'd prefer not to, so I'll talk louder, but if you still can't hear me, let me know. So based on our focus group sessions that Tyson mentioned a moment ago and our own review of the zoning code and land development regulations, we identified these four broad areas of recommended changes. Each section includes a discussion of background and our findings, as well as recommended changes or alternatives to consider. The recommendations are summarized in each of these sections in a box like the one that's shown on the right side of the screen here, and then all of the recommendations are compiled and summarized and prioritized in Section 5, which is the implementation plan. As I said, I'm not going to go through all of the recommendations. There are a lot, but I will cover some of the high points. And then, as Tyson mentioned as well, if there's anything that you are interested in or have questions on, we're happy to spend some more time on that. There also, the slides do have page number references to particular items so that you're able to go right to a particular section in the report. The first area of recommended changes is to create a more user-friendly code. A well-organized development code will increase readability, improve administration, enhance public input by making these complex technical information accessible to casual users, and will further the town's business-friendly objectives by making development standards and procedures clearer to applicants. Recommendations in this section include adding another level of numbered organization between subchapter and section. And on page 13 of the evaluation, which is where this table is excerpted from, you can see an example of how adding another level of organization would make the buffer yard standards much easier to find and reference in the code. Another recommendation that Tyson touched on is to add graphics where they would benefit the reader and use tables to present quantitative information. That graphic at the center of the slide is an example from a code rewrite that we're working on now, where the zoning district dimensional standards are at the top in a table, and then there's a graphic at the bottom that illustrates those. These are some other examples of code graphics showing zero lot line development, pedestrian and street connectivity requirements, as well as screening requirements between residential and non-residential districts. And these are just a few areas of regulation where graphics can be used to improve clarity and readability. The next area of recommended changes is to revise the development review procedures. We heard resoundingly from stakeholders that predictability in the development process is critically important, and that economic development suffers and businesses are reluctant to build when there is considerable uncertainty in the development process. Some stakeholders perceive that decisions by town staff and officials are made in an ad hoc fashion, and we believe this is largely a result of the current development codes. The codes provide insufficient guidance regarding many of the types of decisions that staff and officials must make, such as revisions to approved development plans. And this can result in inconsistent decisions and actions. As shown in the table that's excerpted here, procedural requirements for the town's primary zoning and development-related review procedures are scattered throughout Title 15, not just in the land development regulations and zoning code. Some requirements are difficult to find, many are repeated in more than one section or chapter, but most would benefit from clarification or further details. We recommend actually consolidating all of the procedures into a single chapter and using a common workflow to describe each procedure. This consolidated procedures code section would begin, or could begin, with a summary table of approval processes like the Charleston County example shown here. It provides readers with a quick overview of the various steps in the approval process, who's involved, what kind of notice is involved. And then each procedure listed in the table would have a corresponding code section, and each would be organized into the same workflow. For example, each procedure would have the same subsection, such as applicability, how to initiate an application, approval criteria, etc. The various procedures could also be illustrated through flowcharts, which give readers a more detailed yet still a quick overview of a particular process, and it's another thing that contributes to a more user-friendly, readable code. As y'all saw a few slides back and you're familiar with, the town has a lot of procedures. There are still a few new ones that we would recommend that aren't covered in the code. And one, this first one listed here, zoning permits, would actually be a chance to consolidate a number of existing processes such as conditional uses, temporary uses, short-term rentals, signs, mobile vending. All of those could fall under the umbrella of a zoning permit. That sort of consolidation would improve efficiency and interdepartmental coordination and provide clarity and reliable information for applicants. That zoning permit could then serve as a threshold item for other approvals. For example, it would be part of the application for a building permit or a business license. We also recommend authorizing staff to approve minor changes to plans or minor adjustments to quantitative development standards. The modern best practice is to assign as many procedures as possible to administrative staff when public hearings aren't necessary. And public hearings aren't necessary when a use is subject to very clear regulations defined in the ordinance that leave no room for interpretation or discretion, or where the application is the final step in a multi-step approval process where those discretionary decisions have already been made. Code interpretations, while a revised, clearly written code should reduce the need for staff interpretations of certain provisions, there should still be a formal process for somebody to request a formal interpretation when one is needed. And a related recommendation in the evaluation is to update the codes on a regular basis to reflect these administrative or Board of Zoning Appeals interpretations. And then during the code update process, the town should evaluate and revise the impact assessment procedure to clearly define required elements of the assessment, acceptable levels of service and capacity, and acceptable mitigation requirements. It's also important to consider how to equitably address mitigation among multiple developments in the same geographic area. With more objective approval standards, the town could consider making impact assessments an administrative rather than discretionary approval process, or alternatively, they could just become a submittal requirement for other applications rather than a separate process. The next area of recommended changes is to modernize and improve the development and design standards. This, in particular, is an area where the policy guidance and recommendations in approved plans, such as the comprehensive plan or the Shem Creek Area Management Plan, this is where they're implemented largely. Development and design standards are regulations that can apply to specific zoning districts, uses, or categories of uses. Common ones are setbacks, height, density, parking, landscaping. These are elements that directly shape the density, intensity, design, and character of new development. Applications are typically processed more quickly when development standards are predictable and measurable, which saves applicants time, minimizes staff resource needed to process applications. And the downside is that measurable standards can't capture all scenarios, so the code needs to recognize that and provide clear guidance to decision-making bodies. The town's current developments and design standards are not as clear and consistent as they could be. There are a lot of detailed requirements that don't necessarily improve the end result. Many standards need modernization to reflect current town planning goals as well as national best practices. And specifically, we recommend a comprehensive review and revision of regulations related to signs, tree protection, buffer yards, parking, and open space. Then the final area of recommended change is to update the zoning districts and uses. As part of this analysis, we took a look at how land in the town is zoned. This can help identify an over or under reliance on certain districts, which in turn can help guide changes to the districts. This chart that's shown on the slide shows the amount of land in each of the town's base zoning districts plus the PD districts. You've got 51% of the land in a PD district, 34% in residential districts, and 15% in non-residential districts. Then this chart breaks it down a little bit further. This one is specific to the residential base district, and then there's a similar chart on page 62 for the non-residential districts. But you can see largely the three most frequently used residential districts, R1, RR, and R2, comprise over 80% of the land zoned for residential use in the town outside of the PD district. One district, RC1, isn't used at all, and then the remaining districts each comprise anywhere from 1 to 5% of the land zoned for residential uses. Since the town is in the process of completing its newest comprehensive plan, it's the right time to consider a more comprehensive update and modernization of the current zoning district structure, both residential and non-residential districts, to better implement the plan's land use recommendations. This would include district names, which should better reflect the district's purpose. An agricultural district is needed to ensure working farms, forestry uses, and agricultural support uses can operate without encroachment by potentially incompatible land uses. That also is a comprehensive plan recommendation to implement the intended rural character of certain portions of the planning area. And then finally, the town should consider eliminating the various types of PD districts other than the mixed-use PD, which that's the only PD district that requires a mixture of residential and non-residential uses, which is how planned development district is defined in the South Carolina Planning Act. The evaluation also provides recommendations related to the town's overlay zoning districts. There are 12 of those used for a variety of purposes, some of which may actually be more appropriately addressed through development standards. For example, the comprehensive plan recommends a new gateways and corridors overlay district to sort of streamline and make the zoning along major corridors in the town consistent. There are a number of existing overlay districts that could potentially be integrated into or replaced by this gateways and corridors district, such as the town-county highway corridors buffer, Hungry Neck Venning Boulevard overlay districts. As I said, the standards in those overlays could be incorporated into this new overlay or into just general development standards. The Commercial Design Review Overlay District is used to apply building and site design standards to commercial development. It's a little unusual that these standards are in an overlay district when they apply throughout the town and not just to a particular geographic area. So we recommend eliminating the overlay district, but not the standards. The design standards can be more appropriately located with other development standards like parking and landscaping. The SR2 overlay is another one where the standards could be incorporated into either the base zoning district or here potentially into a revised historic district overlay. And then finally, the Shem Creek waterfront overlay should be updated to implement the recommendations in the management plan. So the town currently uses a use table to list permitted, conditional, and special exception uses, which is a best practice. It does need review to make sure that all of the uses are consistent with the purpose of the districts in which they're located in, and that the use table covers all of the common uses that you might see in Mount Pleasant. There are certain things you can do to improve readability of the table, like this example here from Rock Hill, where they've color-coded the use table to match the colors on the zoning map. In addition, many uses have specific regulations or conditions that apply, and those should be reviewed and updated as well. Allowable housing types should be expanded, which is a fairly simple way to encourage the development of affordable housing. This doesn't require setting income limits or a complex calculation of sales prices. It simply allows appropriate zoning districts to permit smaller lots and housing units, including small multifamily uses like the town's big house dwellings. This variety of housing types on the spectrum between detached single family and mid-rise apartments is often referred to as the missing middle, and you can see from this graphic that there's a wide variety of housing types that should be accommodated in appropriate districts. Based on the findings in the technical codes evaluation, code organization and procedural issues currently are the most pressing concerns in Mount Pleasant. Reorganizing and reformatting, consolidating related provisions, addressing internal inconsistencies, even without making major changes to the standards themselves, would really go a long way in addressing a lot of the concerns that we heard that folks have with the codes. Then clarifying procedural requirements and responsibilities and consolidating all those processes would significantly improve the zoning and land development process. As I've talked about today, the codes evaluation identifies four primary areas of recommended changes to the development codes. We recommend structuring the revision process in phases according to these four primary areas of recommended changes, and these are listed in priority order. But as the implementation plan notes, as Tyson will talk about in a moment, there are a number of ways to structure the next phase in this process, the comprehensive codes revision, including by phase, by priority level of the recommendation, and so forth. But however the town chooses to proceed with the comprehensive code revision process, we recommend two first steps: preparation of an annotated outline and a style guide. The annotated outline just lays out the new order of the code, has like a correspondence table that shows maps current sections to new sections of the code, indicates where related comprehensive plan action items could be implemented, and can also include an explanation of the changes. This outline typically isn't a static document. You expect as you get going on the code rewrite that things need to be reorganized or moved around, and so that annotated outline can evolve as the code update process moves forward. The other item we recommend, a style guide, is really simply to ensure that everything's formatted the same way, you're following all the same, you know, punctuation and capitalization rules and that sort of thing. So that will ensure that everything's consistently organized and formatted, and that's typically a static document that doesn't change. So the code's evaluation offers a number of recommendations in each of those four phases. Some are broad, some are very specific. Then, as I mentioned before, all the recommendations are consolidated at the end into a table in the implementation plan. It assigns each recommendation a high, medium, or low priority to assist staff in prioritizing future amendments to the code. As I noted a second ago, based on available resources, the town could choose to implement all the recommendations in one phase or could address high priority items in multiple phases. And then you can see that a few recommendations listed under phase one are ongoing, and these are recommendations that essentially carry through each phase. For example, adding illustrations or tables or updating and revising definitions. And then also the town could should consider addressing related comprehensive plan action items in conjunction with related elements in the code. In many ways, the comprehensive codes revision process can be seen as an extension or a continuation of the comprehensive planning process. Many of the same stakeholders will be involved, and the code revisions will include specific implementation items that are identified in the plan. So Appendix A to the evaluation includes a public participation strategy that suggests ways for the town to receive public comments and feedback on the draft codes. It includes the usual public engagement strategies like email, social media, and in-person or virtual workshops. And then in addition, we recommend that the town consider establishing a code revision working group that would guide the update process and provide feedback and direction, much like the plan forum did for the comprehensive plan. This group would meet on a regular basis throughout the process. They're not envisioned as public meetings, rather an opportunity for collaboration and coordination on the more technical aspects of the code revision. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
As I just took a bite of chocolate, sorry. Committee, do you have any comments or questions this time?
Okay.
No. Well, thank you so much for.
I'm going to turn it back to Tyson for a closing remark.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks, everyone. Staff asked me to put together what the schedule henceforth could look like in a full code rewrite. For, again, a town this size, with the issues that a town like this faces, I would say the process is roughly a two-year process, mm-hmm. give or take. Now, you've gotten part of that process out of the way because this piece was handled separately, so we've been doing that since January. So I would think if you get the full rewrite underway, or the council authorizes it by gets it underway by October or so, then certainly by the summer of 2020 you could have the process completed. When I laid this out, my thought here was to include about as much public process as you could, about as a thorough review effort as you can make. So there's some efficiencies that could be gained, and when we put together a specific scope of services, that this could change, but this is roughly what you'd be looking at. We typically, as you can see there, we would start off with an annotated outline, which is a process of reorganizing and putting the outline together and the style guide together. But once that's done, then we take the drafting up in three different modules. The first module typically covers zoning districts, use regulations, and the use table. That's just seen sort of as the base of the triangle or the pyramid, if you had to put all the issues into that form. So we take care of that first. That's the one that takes the most time. Once we've established those changes, if there are any rezoning areas or changes to the use tables, then we can deal with development standards a little more easily. And we do that in phase two. That's things like parking, sign regulations, landscaping, buffers, walls, and fences, et cetera. And then in phase three or module three, we deal with procedures and administration. Now, you can guess that there'll be overlap between each of these. I mean, we'll have to take on a procedural issue in module one or two, but We'd like to do that at the end because then we've got the overarching code in place largely, and we can then finalize procedures and that sort of thing. But that's generally how we look at it. We've estimated about a 3 or 4 month adoption period to get it through the process of adoption. Now, we would not be asking the town to adopt modules or any sections of the code as they go through. That would just be one action at the end of the process. What our hope is, though, this can become unwieldy, as you can imagine. What we hope to do with each module is to sort of resolve the issues that are raised in that module. And we're usually pretty successful with that. I would say 90 to 95% of the issues when we leave one module are settled. Some will bleed over, but we hope by the time we get to module 3, most of the substantive issues are dealt with. And then by the time we get to adoption, there's no issue that the community hasn't already discussed. So that's already been brought forward to public hearings, to the Planning Commission, and to the council as well. So any questions about the layout of the project schedule?
Yes, I have a question on module 1 in the zoning district. So if we were to rename zoning districts, that wouldn't actually rezone any properties. It would just change their zoning names.
If it's just changing the name of the district, that's correct.
And with sort of removing some of the overlay districts, I guess when I viewed this sort of update to the code, to me it seemed to be more of a procedural streamlining, make it easier, user-friendly, that kind of thing. But it seems that there are some changes that were discussed in the zoning that seem substantive and policy-based. So I guess my question is where are you gaining your direction on those policy changes?
Well, it would come from stakeholder input, either staff or developer input or stakeholders that spoke to us those days we were here in February talking to them. One of the things that I guess one thing to bear in mind in that area is if there are changes to the zoning districts at that level, say for overlay districts, that's the mode in which we would look at those things. At this point, we're not saying there definitely would be zoning changes, for example, but that's where we would want to address them in the process.
So would council be consult, Mr. DeMora? Yeah,
yes,
you're nodding your head.
I thought that's where you were going is a lot of discussion would take place early on about why the need for this, or is it an overlap? Is it a duplication? Is it causing more issues and it gains us in return? And after those are kind of hammered out, when they're ready, they're baked for you, we bring it to you for your review and consideration. It's possible. I think it makes sense. I'm not sure if this is common. Mm-hmm. You may tell me it's a bad idea. I would love to have a couple council members with us, sleeves rolled up through the entire process, so that there are council advocates who understand the wishes and desires of the rest of council there the whole way of it. So it's not just a process that's done internally with the help of experts and then sort of dumped on your lap and ask you to approve it, but that it's been really a cooperative effort.
Yes, I think that's a great idea, and I mean I'm comfortable being part of that. I don't know if other members of this committee would want to, or we should open up to the full council, but I feel like this council is pretty well aligned as far as development of the town goes, you know, and I think that it would be useful to have someone kind of in there just to sort of help provide guidance as far as, because I mean, bringing some of these changes forth, but bringing forth changes to a council that's not going to approve those changes is not a best in use of time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, all right, Ms. Corley?
I have a question. Eric, where does this fall again? I know that you sort of touched on where this falls with the comp plan, but
correct.
Explain to me that one more time.
Sure, I should have touched on that initially. I know you're finishing up the comprehensive plan adoption process now. As Kelly said, in planning 101, you do the comprehensive plan and then you follow that with implementation, which is largely the code revision process. However, what will always occur in any community with a project this long is there can be changes to the comprehensive plan as you go along. There can be small area plans that will be started and completed and circle around through this process. It's easy enough to fold those issues in as you go.
It just seems like we're not done with that one, and we're starting this one, right?
Yeah, we're proposing a project in North Carolina now where they're going to start each of them simultaneously. So it can be done even at that level, but not ideal. So I think you're lining up with a pretty good approach.
Okay.
You're about wrapping up the comp plan, I assume. You're hoping so anyway.
Yes, yes. We're close.
Okay. I was just going to make one comment to you, ma'am, if I could. It is not uncommon in fact, it's probably typical for us at every module to engage with the governing body. So I would think, I don't want, as the person shepherding this through the process, to get to, you know, June or March of 2022 and have an issue that we haven't heard from the elected officials on. So
okay.
Even though there's no adoption, as you go along, there would be consultation.
Great.
I would anticipate.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from this committee? No. All right. Thank you so much. Is there anything further on this item? Nope. All right. Moving on from item 8, item 9, Planning Commission report and recommendations regarding the treatment of non-conforming properties. This is something that the commission has been taking a look at for a while now. So looking forward to hearing their thoughts.
Yes, this is something that came up, and actually the Sullivan's Point rezoning and other actions that we've taken in terms of changing zoning districts have raised the issue of how do you deal with uses, structures, buildings, sites that don't conform to today's regulations, and how do those get treated? So you asked the Planning Commission to take a look at this. Honest, we started right away doing that, but like many things, Mr. COVID interrupted the schedule. So the Planning Commission has had two special meetings, one at the beginning of March, and they were actually then in their regular March meeting. We're going to hopefully finish up, but that's when we ran into the wall. So only last week did they have the opportunity to do a special meeting on this topic. And as a staff, we gave them a variety of options and alternatives. It's sort of like, don't do anything, maintain what we've got, all the way to kick the can down the road and let's not deal with nonconformities until a code rewrite process or the comprehensive plan. Those, you just explore all the alternatives. Those dropped off the list quickly. And we gave them a number of things to consider, issues that we run into in terms of the sort of the, you know, if you're damaged or destroyed to more than a certain extent, what do I do then? A lot of concern about that here, having just experienced at least a tropical storm. You know, what do you do with buildings? Some communities, and we shared information about different ways that communities do things. Well, if you're residential and you're destroyed, you can build it back to the same height and on the same footprint, but you couldn't change it. So, you know, you kind of make yourself whole. You're still not meeting today's regulations. And the notion is that nonconformities are supposed to go away. You change rules and regulations and policies and plans for a reason. Said, no, this area was industrial or non-residential, and we now want it to be residential, or vice versa. Why would you then allow uses that don't meet your direction to stay forever? So the whole legal premise of this is to eliminate nonconformities. But we've seen that change over the years, and that we'll show you later was probably more important years ago than it is today. One of the things the commission talked about was, well, we need to make sure that, you know, we ought to consider treating different uses differently. You know, residential, well, maybe those are okay, that they can stay longer if they're damaged or destroyed or they don't meet the code. But those non-residential things, those can go away. Well, now you have unequal treatment. You're saying residential is okay. They don't have to meet the ordinance, but non-residential does. You know, why would you go in that direction? And a new sort of a thinking that's emerged is this notion of nonconformities that are, you know, less of a problem than others. And so it uses the term, you know, that maybe there are benign kinds of nonconformities. So you got all this development going on, and maybe a side yard setback got changed in that zoning district, and it used to be 10 feet, now it's 8 feet, and the, you know, some of the buildings don't match. not a huge deal, versus a use that said, we don't want that use there anymore, which would be more detrimental, and you would want to take sort of more aggressive action to remove and eliminate those. So we've started working on that, and we had an opportunity between March and July to, as a staff, to think more about it. And so quickly at their first meeting, some of the options or alternatives were cast aside. So we kept working on these, and this is again where we said, let's focus more on this notion of egregious uses and egregious nonconformities versus minor kinds of things. And the whole idea again on nonconformities, it really came out from sort of decades ago, the idea that you'd have a belching smokestack industry in a residential neighborhood. It doesn't belong and you want to get rid of it. Well, we don't have those kinds of considerations today, and you don't have it in a town like Mount Pleasant. And so there are a lot of reasons why you don't have to be that draconian, that rigorous on these. And we also have a lot, as you talk about it, or economic development was talking a little while ago, that our future is a lot of reuse and redevelopment and infill. So if you have a site where somebody wants to come in and improve that site, just happens that it doesn't have the right amount of parking, or maybe the landscaping or the buffering isn't quite right, you know, our response is, no, you have to bring that up to snuff. You have to bring that all up to today's standards, and they look at you and say, you know, I'm out of here. I'm not going to pursue this project. Well, perhaps they ought to be able to improve it to the highest degree possible. And if you're missing a shrub, or the buffer that gets put in is a certain distance or width, that's all they can fit, and it doesn't meet the standard, that's better than a vacant, dilapidated, unused site that doesn't get, you know, generate any value for the town. And so that's the way we've been going, and talking with the commission, that we ought to look at some of these and be a little, have more variety in the way we treat these, rather than sort of a one size, if you're nonconforming, you're nonconforming, and, you know, we don't want you here, to a more accommodating kind of approach. And so what we showed them was the idea that maybe we have to introduce, we deal with uses. This is sort of a scale or a spectrum. Those are the most detrimental. Then maybe you have some structures, and perhaps, I mean, our definition of structures includes everything. I mean, it can be the gazebo in your backyard. And so if you happen to have a gazebo that's located too close to the property line because it was put there 20 years ago and today it needs to be a little further away, is that really a huge deal? Or can you just let that one pass and not worry about minor structures, accessory structures, and you treat it a little bit differently? And then we move on to the sites or other nonconformities. Again, this would be parking or landscaping. I mean, in some cases, to meet today's requirement, a developer would have to go rip out existing parking in order to be able to, say, put landscaping and buffering in, and they would then negate their ability to provide adequate parking. And do you really want to go that far? And then we have some other nonconformity provisions that deal with, you know, minor, smaller issues along the way. So what the Planning Commission did last week was, their recommendation to you for today is that you instruct us as a staff and with the commission that we could bring back some draft actual language along these lines. And so we would pay attention to making distinctions between really detrimental versus benign nonconformities and adjust the regulatory approach accordingly. We would also deal with things like if it's neglect, and you're, you know, a building or a property is neglected, and then when you go to improve it, you exceed a certain percentage of improvement. Well, you've neglected it. You haven't paid attention to that. You get a different treatment than somebody whose home or business was damaged or destroyed by a hurricane, for instance. That was a huge issue in the Shem Creek area. What happens if, in the extreme, how might we redevelop and recreate the Shem Creek area, and to what degree? You're never going to go and be able to recreate what's there today if you apply our current nonconformity provisions. It's, I mean, uses wouldn't be allowed. locations of buildings wouldn't be there, parking would be insufficient, et cetera, et cetera. And so we have this ability to distinguish and say if things are destroyed by a natural disaster, you get a break, as opposed to ignoring your property and maintaining it. We would then pursue these distinctions between how a property is used versus some aspects of the site that aren't as important. And that rule of, you know, to what degree do you, can you make improvements before you have to bring it up to snuff? Ours is 50% of the replacement value of, say, a structure. But we've seen ordinances from across the state even where it varies. Some go 75%. Charleston doesn't have a percentage. They have a whole different approach deciding whether or not what improvements you're going to make have to meet today's rules or not. And so that's our recommendation from the Planning Commission at this point, is to keep us keeping on with this path, and then and be in a position to be able to bring back something in an ordinance format fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's what we've got for you today.
Great. Members of the committee, do you have any questions?
It looks like they've spent a lot of time figuring it out, and I'm glad that they did, because I'm sure they did a better job than we would have done time-wise. So it looks good. Looks good.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be one less section in the new code that we would have to rewrite later, because it'd be we'd be ahead of schedule.
I did have a question. So it seemed to me when we brought up this non-conforming, the big concern was someone has a house, a hurricane comes and knocks it down. Are they able to rebuild what they had? And that seemed to me to be the problem that we were trying to solve. It seems like some of this goes a little almost too far in allowing nonconformities to exist, because we do want nonconformities to go away. And we do want, you know, if someone, I think there's a big distinction between natural disaster and neglect, right? And if someone wants to tear down a building and redevelop that, I think they would have to bring it up to snuff. And I think that's the whole point of changing in zonings and overlay districts and that kind of thing, is that we're thinking long term for those regions of what they're going to look like. So I think, I guess that's just my commentary as this moves forward, is to consider the problem that we're trying to solve, which is hurricane knocks over your house, you want to be able to rebuild it, and then not going too far in allowing nonconformities to continue. Because then otherwise, it seems like, you know, the crossed off one of like, just let it all go. We don't want to do that.
Right. Yes. And that's just that balance. We saw it as an opportunity once we opened it up to focus on that damage or destruction and percentage and what's allowed. If we're going to do it all right. And if we have the opportunity to fix related things, again, sort of more those below the surface of an iceberg that council might not necessarily see, but we deal with all the time. But it doesn't say we couldn't bring forward sort of a first batch of amendments that would instantly address that particular issue, Ms. Whitley, and then we could follow up with subsequent ones, you know, they could trail along and eventually get there.
Okay.
So we can look at breaking it up and solving that. And then that is an issue, say, for the Sullivan's Point neighbors and neighborhood. You know, how would we fix it fairly quickly? But we think we can do all of this fairly quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to say the heights and the taking the overlay that kind of triggered all this. So the
simplest was another
way to correct things that we know we're going to be faced with, I guess, without, like you say, going too far would be ideal.
Okay. All right. Any other thoughts? No? All right. That's item number 9 on the agenda. Moving on to item number 10, an update on the Settlement Communities Task Force applications.
Yes, ma'am. I'll just take a brief moment of your time. I just wanted to give you an update because the applications for the Settlement Community Task Force closed this past Saturday. So that was the deadline, the extended deadline that we had made. We received 40 applications. Those are the actual applications. I did receive 3 other emails from people who said they'd like to serve. And I said, okay, here's the application, please send it to me. And I never got those back. So I don't know if you want to put those names in the hat too or not. That's a decision for y'all, I guess. But the other decision for y'all is to figure out where we are going next with this. Obviously, we've got
you know, 40 people at least who are willing and want to serve in this capacity. So I guess that's a big group to have conversations, but.
Well, I think that we had initially talked about having a 12 to 15 member settlement communities task force of 12 to 15 members. So and I know that the process that we go through to appoint other council, other council appointed groups is to give the applications to the council for review. And then in executive session, we select the members. And I think that that would be the same procedure that we should follow for this. How does the committee feel about that?
Yeah.
Yes. And I would include those three emails.
Yeah. Is that something prior to this coming council meeting?
It's too soon for everyone to review 40 applications prior to next Tuesday. I think it may be a little bit too much, but if we could get those printed and put in our boxes for everyone to review, I think with that many, it's easier to have a physical copy than to try and have all the attachments and get that in everyone's box and have that on the agenda for September's meeting for selection of those.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I would like if the staff could look at the application and say what part of the town it's from. In other words, is it from Snowden? Is it from 10 Mile?
The application. There was a.
Well, if you could highlight that.
Certainly.
Because to me, I think we need to make sure
we're covered.
We're covered in all areas of the town.
Sure.
So if you could somehow highlight that, so if we get 40 applications, we got 3 from Snowden, 4 from 4 Mile, 10.
You want me to organize them by settlement?
Well, some way to highlight that,
okay.
If you could.
Yeah, thank you. All right, any other thoughts on that? All right, that's item number 10. Okay. Item number 11 on the agenda is action to allow temporary structures such as tents or trailers. So I placed this on the agenda earlier last week because I've been in touch with one school that has been asking about this because they want to move some or more of their classrooms outside by putting out sort of tent-like structures. And then also I'm on the committee for my church's reopening for COVID and has also considered putting out tents. And I know that there's other organizations that like schools and churches in the community that are looking to do this that are potentially not even realizing that they would be violating town ordinances by taking away parking and putting up these structures. So I think that given the era that we are in, we need to have an emergency ordinance in place that allows for this because we want to encourage people to be able to gather in a safe manner and for school to start in a safe manner. And I think that allowing the same thing that we did for restaurants, where we allowed restaurants to take over parking spaces in order to do outdoor dining to preserve their businesses, I think we need to do a similar thing for schools and churches. So that's all I have on that. Any thoughts?
We also have other uses. I think I've mentioned, one we're working on and we actually haven't temporary use changes to our temporary use regulations that start to get at this. We've had numerous requests for temporary outdoor movie theaters. So how do you handle that? Our ordinance knows things as sort of truly temporary or a special event, a road race or whatever, or permanent, but it doesn't really know semi-temporary, sort of kind of permanent, or how long does it last? And so we're looking at that already for those, and there may be a way to do something, an interim fix through an action of council, but then know that if we work on an actual ordinance to be able to deal with this for a longer period of time, it may need to address other uses too and not lock yourself in, because the first thing that'll happen is somebody will ask for some other activity that you didn't think of. So just point that out to you as we would move forward.
Thank you. And I think we do need, and I'm going to ask this committee for a recommendation for Tuesday night that we do something because school's about to start. And so so the folks need to have some certainty with regards to this. Ms. Hyatt?
When you said like semi-permanent movie, would that be something maybe that they should have to get approved monthly or, because if it's sort of Temporary, it's like how long will it be allowed, kind of a thing. Should they apply every month or every 90 days?
We talked about that with the Planning Commission
on
that particular one, and the sort of the question becomes somebody, I mean, our request, for instance, was for, say, a period of a year or 18 months, we'd like to have outdoor movies. And, I mean, you read national stories, they're doing, movie theater is, company is coordinating with Walmart to be able to do these temporary drive-in movies in Walmart parking lots. So this could last a while. And part of the problem was saying, well, we'll let you do it for a month and then maybe we'll won't let you do it the next one. I mean, somebody's going to want to know, am I going to be able to do this for a reasonable period of time? Now, granted, if they violate, you know, the provisions and they're really, you know, out there, that's a different case. But setting something up to know that, well, I could do this for 6 months or 12 months, might, you know, we'd have to think about the time frame.
Right, because if it turns out to be a nightmare, like by constantly violates a noise ordinance or something,
we have other
having to
ways
put up with that for
18
months for the neighbors would be too long.
Right,
so
our noise ordinance would then kick in and it wouldn't matter.
That was an example, but it's like if it caused traffic nightmares or something, we might want a way to undo it, but it would need to be a reasonable amount of time.
Can I get a motion from someone to put this on the agenda for Tuesday? Oh, yeah.
Just a reminder about the context that we discussed forward. Of course, if you do it as an emergency ordinance, you recollect last
it's 60 days.
Only for 2 months.
Yes.
So we have to continue to, otherwise, we have to do a 2-reading change to it.
Yes, thank you for that reminder. Yes, this would be an emergency update to get this on the books for now, understanding that the Planning Commission was going to be coming through with something more comprehensive. But this would be this would provide some relief now, immediately as the school is starting for the fall. All right, is there anyone who'd like to make the motion? All right.
So we're making a motion to
recommend to council.
Recommend to council allow temporary structures.
Do you want me to say the whole thing?
Go ahead.
So we're making a motion to recommend to council to consider allowing temporary structures such as tents or trailers through an emergency ordinance for schools and churches in order to allow for greater social distancing.
All right. Do I have a second?
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? No. All right. Unanimous. Is there anything else to come before us? Any other comments or thoughts from people on the committee? All right. Then item number 12 is adjourned. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.